Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Yana Byers, and I'm here with Sharon Strokia, professor of history at Emory University, to talk about her newest book, Forgotten Healers, Women in the Pursuit of Health in Late Renaissance Italy. Hi, Sharon. How are you?
I'm doing well, Yana. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Oh, thanks. I'm very excited. I loved the book, and I'm really so excited to talk to you about it. So
likewise.
Wonderful. So how is Atlanta? Are you teaching face-to-face?
Atlanta is at the moment wet and soggy, but warm. And no, we're doing everything online.
Yeah. Okay. That's a whole new set of challenges, huh?
Yeah, it is. For everybody, teachers, students, staff, pacing is a lot more difficult than I had imagined. But we're getting closer to the end.
Yeah. One more semester, I think, and then maybe back to normal. Great. Well, speaking of back to normal, I don't know where I wanted to go with that segue. But so let's just, I want to dive in. So my first question, as always, is an attempt to kind of place this book in your narrative as an historian. And so, thinking back, my favorite part of Death and Ritual was your exploration of the role of women in the funerary rites and what that meant for their position as important members in the kin group. Then Nuns and Nunneries shone a light on the centrality of female monastic life in the battles of what we call the era of reformations writ large. So here I see you moving your spotlight to a new area, suggesting that women were not only involved in Renaissance medicine, but were in fact central to its practice and progress. Is that a fair characterization of how this is going?
I think that's a really good summation of my own intellectual trajectory. So as I was trained as a social and cultural historian of Renaissance Italy and published those earlier books and other articles that really dealt with the various intersections of women, family, and religion in 15th and 16th century Italy. But about 10 years ago, I started to get interested in the history of health and healing, but I had no training in that field. So I thought the best way to approach some of these issues in the history of medicine was through the lens of gender and the lens of labor history, rather than trying to contend with materials I knew very, very little about, like academic medicine or modes of textual transmission. So the way I see this book in terms of my long-term intellectual makeup is that it does represent a combination of abiding interests that you signaled earlier, but interwoven with newer questions about knowledge production, about commercial innovation, and the early modern culture of empiricism. So I would say that I've retained all of those earlier interests, but now try to respond to what has often been called the material turn in early modern studies.
Very nice. That must have been fun. I've been thinking a lot about what you're consulting. So, and I would like you to tell our listeners about that. So let's talk about your sources for a moment. What are you using? Where did they come from? How did you find them? What's the relationship between the source base and your argument? Just you know, just talk a little bit about that for me.
Yeah, as you probably know, I'm an archive rat of the first order. I just love working in Italian archives, and in particular in Florentine archives. So I came to Forgotten Healers partly by accident and partly by design, because once I finished my previous book on nuns and nunneries in Renaissance Florence, I learned that I had collected all kinds of fragmentary archival material that documented religious women as healthcare practitioners, particularly in the realm of pharmacy and nursing. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just try to do something small with this until I settle on a new project. But I realized that, in fact, this was a new project. And then I just went full bore and tried to really look for other kinds of materials. So I think just to address your question more directly, one source base that looms very large in the project is a narrative source base comprised of letters. Women in the 15th and 16th century wrote just a large number of letters. I think it was, you know, a very feminine genre. They established epistolary networks. And so I'm using a lot of letters, particularly coming from the Medici court, but also from institutions like convents. So nuns were great letter writers, in part because they couldn't get out and about. So, you know, narrative sources that range from letters to kind of chronicle descriptions of miraculous cures or canonization proceedings and the like, which have a sort of narrative form. But I try to enrich and check those narrative sources with more what I would just call a kind of a quantitative data coming from account books, right? So Italians were wonderful paper pushers, and they kept all kinds of account books, sometimes interlaced with narratives, so that you can find not only the numbers of you know, what convents were selling at what price and so forth. But you know, those are interspersed with little narrative entries. So it's a kind of hybridized form. But the count books were a wonderful rich source to tap. And then, of course, things like statutes that would give me a more prescriptive sense, petitions that were attached to statutes. So things that are not perhaps linear in the way we think about them because of the way they were archived. And then finally, visual materials. I do try to make some use of visual materials, such as manuscript illustrations, material objects like pharmacy jars and so forth.
Wonderful. As you're talking, I'm nodding along. Yes, of course. This sounds so familiar. It is funny. So many historians, when you ask them what brought them to their new project, they're going to say, well, I was working on this thing, but then I found this in the archive. It's like, it's so true. Wonderful.
It is. And I think, you know, this is how history, you know, can have a great deal of intention behind it, but is also very serendipitous.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, you know, you go to the archive and it's hard not to be inspired when you're in such a wonderful space. Sometimes cold, but good space. All right. So the next, we've got a couple big questions here. So my super big, what do you see as the primary argument with this book? What's your overarching argument?
Well, my overarching argument is that, simply put, a wide range of women were involved in healthcare and medical provisioning, and that they were socially important to the delivery of healthcare services in this period. And I think where I want to give that an edge is to say that I would argue that the increased demand for healthcare services, coupled with this growing interest in preventive health practices, actually opened new opportunities for Italian women to participate in both the medical economy and in emerging cultures of experimentation. So that argument runs contrary to an older historiographical convention that says that, you know, women healers were marginalized in the 16th century in line with professionalization.
Mm-hmm. And I see that as a really important contribution. That is such an old saw, this idea that as any profession becomes professionalized, women get written out of it. Well, and they may get written out of it, but that doesn't, by historians, but that doesn't place women outside of this situation. And so I think that's a really major contribution, and I love it.
Thank you.
It was a really fun book. It was a great book. So what can you tell me kind of what you consider to be your other main contributions to the discourse?
Yeah, well, because the book has such a sweeping panorama in terms of the kinds of practitioners I'm looking at, I see that potentially my book has the ability to contribute to a couple of different areas. So I would just single out three different areas where I feel like the project broke new ground. And the first would be that my study takes a more body-centered approach to healthcare that focuses attention on what Renaissance Italians actually did to treat and prevent illness. So for instance, as opposed to thinking about academic medicine or the wonderful developments that are taking place in the university around dissection and the learning of anatomy, I'm really more concerned with what people are doing, right, in as frontline healers, in managing illness, in understanding bodies from different points of view. So one of the results of that body-centered approach is that we can cut across the widest possible range of activities and social strata. So as I hope we'll discuss later in the podcast, some of the people we'll meet in the course of the book really cover a very broad range from the top echelons of the Medici court, you know, all the way through orphaned girls who are working in syphilis hospitals. So I think that this body-centered approach allows us as scholars to appreciate the value and meanings that contemporaries attach to different services within this pluralistic medical marketplace. Mm-hmm. So that would be one area where I contribute to the discourse. A second area would be that I argue that Italian women working outside traditional guild and academic settings became invested in empirical knowledge making through the pursuit of health. So I think that my study expands the reach of empirical culture into the female spaces of Renaissance courts, convents, and charitable institutions. And in this way, I'm taking a primarily skills-based view of early modern knowledge production that emphasizes how the work of the mind and hand were unified. So that kind of approach allows me to examine the ways that bodywork provided avenues for Italian women to participate in the culture of experimentation, through making remedies or through writing out different recipes and exchanging them, through to trying out different kinds of care practices and so forth. So that would be a second area. And then a final area would be to look at the commercial dimensions of women's pharmacy work in late Renaissance Italy. We've learned quite recently that women were very much engaged in different kinds of pharmaceutical work, making remedies, but no one before my study, I think, has really leaned into looking at these female-run businesses. So I'm looking particularly at convent pharmacies because, of course, convents as institutions kept excellent records, and they were also extremely important vendors within this medical marketplace. So what I was trying to do in the book was to show how nuns worked at the nexus of the market and the laboratory as both medical artisans and entrepreneurs. And I'm able then to reconstruct what their business looked like, what kind of products they sold, their clients, have a little bit about prices and so forth. And I think that makes a contribution then to both economic and labor history. So those would be my three areas.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's amazing. That's you're just like, okay, just let me radically change the way we think about this. Done. Well done. Okay, so you know, you bring up these groups of women you discuss in detail. So let's spend some time on them. All right, and we'll start with the top of the food chain, the top of the social strata, scale with the Medici, old friends of all Florentine historians. So talk to me about these women. What did you learn? How do they help us understand this topic?
Well, one of the things that I learned about Renaissance women in general is that they tend to have a pretty high degree of health literacy. And that is a surprising thing, because the sort of conventional wisdom is that, you know, much of the sort of home-based practice of, you know, was not very biomedically astute, right? Mm-hmm. And it was all folklore and sort of, you know, has a pejorative connotation. And I think one of the things I wanted to say about court women in particular was that they had, you know, a good bit of training in the making of medicines, in learning how to diagnose illnesses, in using various sensory repertoires to understand the human body, reading vernacular texts. So they were really well prepared, even though they were living in a situation where they could literally call up a court physician who could treat anything, you know, from an academic standpoint. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things that really caught my eye in terms of the early Medici court in particular was the high level of health literacy, and then the way that Medici duchesses and court ladies actually put their skills to work in diagnosing illnesses, in making collaborative medical decisions with court physicians, sometimes running contrary to the medical advice of court physicians, you know, who were on the payroll and so forth. And so there is a kind of negotiation of power that revolved around the issuance of healthcare directives. People had their own plans oftentimes for what kind of therapies they wanted to use in case of illness. So there are a couple of things I think of interest. And then also the other thing I would just mention quickly is that courts kind of cut across the social spectrum in that they employed a large number of people who were not noble or who were not patrician. And it was interesting to see how some of the lower tier employees and servants at the Medici court were integrated into the process of decision making and healthcare provisioning. And I was thinking particularly of wet nurses and the so-called matrons or nurses of this Medici nursery that grows literally year by year.
Of course. Oh, that is that really does kind of change the our understanding of power and like the idea that there's a negotiation there. It's really, that's new. It's fascinating. So with nuns, you're back on familiar ground as well, yes. Continuing to help us see the way convents were intertwined with like just so many layers of urban Italian life. What's going on there?
Well, this was, I think, one of my first clues from previous work. You know, these account books were meticulous in many ways, you know, because nuns had to have their books audited. They kept their own records, right? And so they were able to write down in whatever detail they felt was appropriate of various kinds of expenses or things that might have escaped the attention of somebody like a notary and so forth. So the fact that these are female-generated records, by and large, I think also gives us a unique perspective. So that I was already aware of. But one of the things that was the initial thread linking my previous work with this book was the sense that nuns were very much involved in making medicines and then also marketing them to a much broader lay public. And they did that because it was such an important revenue stream for them. I knew that convents were always on the edge of, you know, going under financially. They were always looking for new sources of support in this mixed economy. And so right around 1500, I learned that from again, my archival sources, that nuns began to commercialize what had been a long healing tradition and started to explore new little niche markets, first with their longstanding business partners and with their traditional clients, their female allies and patrons, but then very rapidly started to expand their businesses within, say, 20 years by 1520 or so. And then everyone got in the game. So this became a very robust revenue stream for female convents.
And then finally, hospitals, which I think are the places most likely to be linked with the great male physicians and like medical theorists. So what's the contribution of women here?
Well, I'm thinking here more about patient care and who's actually doing, you know, who's performing the daily grind of hospital care. And I focused in particular on these new hospitals that were developed in response to a new disease of syphilis. So these pox hospitals, as they're often called, they're hospitals for syphilitics. They're hospitals that just flourish after, again, about 1520. And the syphilis patients needed a great deal of care when they took this particular therapy, when they took a treatment that was designed to certainly reduce their symptoms, but hopefully put them back on the road to good health. And they were oftentimes in the hospital for 1 to 2 months. So, you know, who's taking care of them? You know, the syphilis hospitals employed a salaried physician who would make the rounds, not necessarily every day, but a couple of times a week. And so patient care is really left in the hands of these healthcare workers who I saw as essential to the development of new routines, certainly to the recovery of poor syphilitic patients. And so what I was interested there is was in their medical know-how and how they gained that know-how, what kind of work they did. I discovered that they made medicines for all of the hundreds, if not thousands, of patients in the hospitals and on an industrial scale. And so they were really, you know, working at a level that was well beyond the level of the household, making medicines for, you know, members of their family unit. I mean, this is really a major enterprise with quite literally tons and tons of materia medica being processed annually.
So we've got women diagnosing illness, prescribing medicine, making those medicines, selling those medicines, administering those medicines, and literally, like, physically, bodily providing care for hundreds of people. That's sweeping, right? That's kind of this. We see this is women involved in every stage of the process. That's really a profound effect. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's really a good summation. What I was trying to show was by looking at different spaces and different scales, that there's just this tremendous, deep, profound investment and resource that has been unheralded. And that's why I called the book Forgotten Healers, because, you know, these women working from, say, the household and, you know, even a court setting or the household court setting, all the way to large institutions catering to many, many thousands of inhabitants, you know, really were central to the delivery of healthcare in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Mm-hmm. In a fairly sophisticated medical system, it seems.
Yes.
Yeah. So am I leaving anything out there? What else do we need to discuss?
You know, I think that you've appreciated my appreciation for, you know, the skill levels of, you know, a variety of different female healers. I think what I would just emphasize is the ways in which some of these women, certainly not all, but a number of them became hooked, if you will, on kind of scientific experimentation. Right? They really enjoyed working with their hands. They enjoyed experimenting with materials. They often had the kind of, you know, physical setup in a kitchen that would allow them to tinker and tweak different recipes. And so I think one of the things I found most engaging was the ways in which women with inquiring minds use their skilled hands to really make changes in terms of medicine, and then kind of use that the sort of practical knowledge they acquired as a springboard sometimes towards a more theoretical understanding.
And this has some important implications too for just the way we think about the, you know, so-called scientific revolution. And I think, well, as you brought up, you know, centering this on the body, and like what experimentation means, like what practice means, you know, it's very, there's a lot of things to think about with this work.
Yes.
Cool. So are you going to be spending any more time with it, or what's next? What are you working on now?
So I will be carrying forward a couple of the strands from this book, and I just launched a new book project that I'm tentatively calling Health for Sale, which explores the commercial culture and the medical marketplace in the same period in early modern Italy, roughly 1550 to 1700. And here again, I want to challenge some conventional takes. So the story to date is that Italian state authorities regulated the medical market primarily by means of new licensing agreements, new licensing mechanisms. And again, that was the way in which women were filtered out. But I take a more trust-based approach to the way medical consumers were created and cultivated. So for instance, I want to explore different market innovations, such as the origins of pharmaceutical brands and printed medical advertisements, again, in the 16th and 17th centuries, which we tend not to associate with the origins of, you know, big pharma. But I have a great deal of archival material about things like drug patents and the organization of early modern drug trials that included human subjects. So I've got issues of branding and drug trials and pharmaceutical, if not monopolies, then certainly trademarks and so forth. So this is obviously a timely subject, but one mm-hmm. whose roots run remarkably deep, I think, into the early modern period.
That's wonderful. I'm very excited about that book.
Thank you.
I can't wait to interview you about that, which, you know, a little bit of time. I know it'll take a minute, but I'll be ready when you finish it. All right. Thank you so much for your time. I'm really grateful. And I have, you know, I've been reading your books you've been following you as a scholar for a very long time. So it means a lot to me to get to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you so much. Thank you for your excellent questions, really provocative and excellent questions. I appreciate it.
That's lovely to hear. Thanks very much. All right. Until next time.
Okay. Thank you.
Ciao.